In this episode, you'll hear Dave Bangs, author, campaigner, activist and advocate for the natural world and our right to enjoy it. Dave lives in Sussex, in the south of England, and this area is the focus of his incredible attention. Dave has written three fantastic books on the subject, and I will share links to these in the description of the podcast. Meeting Dave showed me another story about landscape and place, this time a political one. Feels important to put this out there now. Previous guests on this podcast have talked about the health and well-being benefits of connecting to our landscape and our history, but there's something more here, about our fundamental rights as people, and about equality of access to the resources and benefits of the natural world.
I'm Dave Bangs, and I feel at the moment as though I've lived in Brighton all my life, but I haven't. We came back to Brighton from the Midlands when I was seven, and I stayed here until I was 18 and went away to university. But I never lost that touch with it. I thought my childhood years in Sussex were extremely formative for the way I see the world. And by the time I left Sussex when I was 18, I'd gone backwards and forwards across the entire county, backwards and forwards, mostly using trains as the backbone of my travels, but sometimes going by bike. I'd used either of my parents' old bikes, which they hadn't used for years, or just walking mostly, or occasionally using buses. And in the final years, after 66, when the beaching cuts on the branch line network really hit in, after those breakages had been made, I started using buses, but found it much more difficult. And in effect, my travels became much more limited because I didn't have the puff and and didn't want the stress of waiting at lonely rain-swept bus stops for buses that might not come. Whereas waiting on a train platform for a train that might not come is a much more homely experience. For the first two or three years, I used to go out with my brother. My brother's nearly 2 years older than me. But that petered out as he got older. He did other things, and I stuck with what I was doing. My habit was to go out every Saturday. Every single Saturday, I'd go somewhere. I was fortunate because I didn't have to work. I didn't have to have a part-time job, and my mum would give me a bit of pocket money, 2 bob, 2 and 6, if I had a train fare to go. No food, didn't even take water. But she'd give me that basic bung just to finance the train ticket, and off I'd go. That was a consistent pattern, winter and summer, through the whole of those 7 years. I'd always been interested in the countryside. I'd always been interested in nature. It always turned me on. I think I inherited from my mother a focused interest in nature and the countryside, but my mother had no resource of detailed knowledge of nature, and so I went for all those years without really coming to grips with the names of birds, rare birds. I knew the names of plants and flowers and orchids and things like that because that was my mother's interest, and that is what you get on the Downs. But it was only much later, when I was on the point of returning down here to Sussex, that I developed a really focused interest. I made up for all those years of not really doing the hard work of naming things. To me now is really important. You know, I love finding out what things are, how they live. But I didn't know a lot about what I was looking at. I just loved being in nature, really, in the countryside. That's the way most people experience the countryside. They experience it as immersion in tranquility, greenness. The reason I got into writing, I mean, I used to be a painter, for many years. When I was in London, I trained at an art college. Well, I didn't train there. I've got to say I was untrained at St Martin's School of Art. It was a dreadful dump. But I did go through the mill of art college, A levels and art college, and after that got into public art, into mural painting. I did that for about 10 years in central London, and I did some good work. I did some rubbish work, but I got better, and with other people, I ended up doing some quite good work, and I found myself getting more and more interested in depicting nature. Even when I was doing a mural that wasn't explicitly about nature, I'd end up sneaking nature in. So, for instance, I did a big mural about the Tolpuddle Martyrs, the agricultural labourers who were transported to Australia for joining a trade union back in 1834. And I did a big memorial mural on the gable end of a pub in Islington about them. And I sneaked in this giant lime tree. So the picture was basically of this huge demonstration and the presentation of this gigantic petition to Parliament. But dominating it was this picture of a gigantic lime tree, as I say, 45 foot tall. And it was done very, very realistically. I'd finished painting the lime tree and the scaffold had come down and I was painting the base of the mural. At one afternoon, I heard this awful squawk and thud and looked up the wall and saw a crow sliding down the wall above my head. The poor wretched creature had flown straight at this lime tree, thinking it was a... He was fooled by my trompe-l'oeil, or whatever you say. Trompe-l'oeil, trompe-l'oeil, I never know how to say that. I thought that was some tribute to my painting skills. But, yeah, I kept sneaking nature in. So when I came back down to Brighton, I was no longer a painter, but I wanted somehow to advocate for nature, and it seemed that a better way of doing that was writing. Almost my entire motivation for writing, the three books that I've done and other bits that I've written, 95% of the motivation I've got for writing those books is political, really. Basically what those books are saying is you've got to know this countryside or you're going to lose it. You know, the way capitalism works is that its form of organisation is the city and then a super exploited hinterland, you know, from where it gets primary products and that, food and minerals and timber and all the rest of it. What happens in the way we live is that the vast majority of us are crammed into big, denatured, built environments, villages, then towns, then cities, now mega cities. And that means that we lose all connection with where we come from and with nature. And therefore, we're not in a position to fight for its retention. Because we've lost that connection with it, because we're alienated from it, we can't fight for it. And yet we are the only people who can stop nature being destroyed, because the nature of capitalism is that it's a monster out of control. There's no stop button on it. Its whole dynamic is built on mad, irrational expansion, you know. And so with the best will in the world, you know, capitalists who don't want to completely shit on their own doorsteps halt that process, the only people who can do that are us, our class, working people. And yet, as a class, we're the most alienated from nature. So that's the paradox, that we have the power to stop the destruction of nature, but capitalism's forcible alienation of us from nature means that we're least equipped to do it. So that's really what my books are about. They're saying, look, there's this out here. Enjoy it. Get out there. Immerse yourself in it. Because if you don't know this, you can't fight for it. The people who live in the countryside now are rich people, privileged people. And privileged people, I have no doubt, love that rural space, but they can't fight for it. Their own class interests stop them fighting for the preservation of those spaces. They depend for their profits on exploitation of nature, the destruction of nature. So us lot, who here we are in our towns and cities, we're the folk who are going to have to do the business, really. Mm. You know, I come from a middle-class background, so it's not it's not unemployment or sheer poverty or insecurity which drove me to socialist politics. It's not. It was my experience in the 60s, which were the worst decade, really, for the destruction of our countryside that we've ever seen, really. That was the time when I was an adolescent. My mother, before the Second World War, she remembered what that landscape was like, and she mourned it. On every walk, she'd tell us what these places used to be like, and mourn the fact that the Downs had become what they were, which is basically a desert, a tilled desert, a crop-growing, corn-growing desert, with all the ancient, wildlife-rich down pastures, sheep walks, which stretched for miles and miles in her memory without fence or hindrance, and just the sound of skylarks up above and the soft turf under your feet, which meant that you could walk forever without really getting tired, and the smell of thyme and the smell of gorse flowers. All that she had very clear pictures of in her mind, and she passed them on to me, and I guess to my brother. So that was always in my mind too. So by the time I was first exploring the Downs, you were probably through three quarters of that process we were through, really. You were already dealing with the last knockings. It didn't first put me on the left. I mean, in the early 1960s, well, in the right the way through till I left home, really, I was mostly on the right, politically. I was very political, very angry. The destruction of nature was the focus of my anger, but the conclusions I drew weren't left-wing conclusions. They were right-wing conclusions. I thought that we had it actually made sense to go back to the past, to go back to the old days, you know, of before the Industrial Revolution, you know, when you know, the old myth of, you know, the sweet harmony between the squire in his manor house and the vicar at the church door, and the happy village folk, you know, doffing their caps and that. I thought that was a real model of stability and unchangingness, in which you know, nature was unthreatened by us. It took leaving home and being immersed in all that was really happening in the wider world for me to draw the opposite conclusions from the same motivation, really, that actually this is the complete opposite of the truth, that it's these people you associate with tradition and timelessness and continuity were actually the builders of... They were the builders of the system of destruction which was destroying nature. You know, it didn't stop them, you know, when they grubbed their profits escaping to their pieces of nature and living out their harmonious lives in the patches that were still not yet destroyed by their system. But actually it was them and their system which were destroying their nature, destroying nature. The old countryside was a palimpsest of extraordinary richness, really, in terms of what survived of nature, lying alongside a really dynamic, productive capacity. And that, I mean, you know, if you think of farming at the in the last stages before the kind of triumph of rural industrialisation, you know, in high Victorian farming and before that, back to through the age of enclosure and that, the countryside was a very productive place, you know, but it was a productivity that sat alongside a very high degree of preservation of really rich ecosystems and of the marks and layers of previous cultures. And that's particularly so in the extraordinary way on the Downs, where because of the sheep and corn economy, all the marks of previous cultures way back to the beginning of agriculture and before lay intact under the mantle of turf, really, and until that industrialising post-war wave, really, and and that was the end of all that. What happens under capitalism is that all ecosystems are assimilated to one, really. All ecosystems basically are just grist for creating a clean, even, machine-accessible factory floor with no impeding irregularities of contour or drainage or landscape features like field boundaries and copses and shores, ponds, all those unnecessary things which create such richness in the traditional countryside. Capitalism just rubs out all those unevennesses. It's going for, it wants to eliminate labour from the productive process because capitalism makes its profit from labour. So the less labour it can exploit, the more intensely, the more efficient, this is the paradox, the more efficient capitalism can be, really. Mm. Capitalism doesn't make big money from exploiting a workforce of hundreds and thousands of us in the farm landscape. It makes its money from super exploiting a very small amount of labour power on the landscape, really. So it strips out land-based labour. It strips out all individual physiographic and landscape features just to make an even factory floor to exploit. I think the basic rule for the conservation of nature is that your first task always is to conserve that which is there at the moment. And what we have in this country is a tapestry of a multi-layered tapestry of ecosystems which are partially the creation of people. In interaction with nature, people exploiting nature for their survival, and I don't see that as a negative. I see that as a positive, really. That if you look at the old countryside, you know, on any mixed farm, you would have an extraordinary range of smaller ecosystems which mimic much larger ones. If you look at a coppice wood preserved for wood products, for hurdles, for furniture, for mending machinery, or timber for barn and house construction, or whatever, or levees around a watercourse, or bridges. That woodland, the structuring of that woodland would mimic the natural structure which had existed before we destroyed the big mega beasts, the mega herbivores, which had previously been the agents which had created that structural diversity within the woodland. You'd see on every farm, you'd see a variety of wetland habitats. You know, if they've got streams going through them, you'd have meadows and residual marsh. You'd have clear streams and cloudy streams. You'd have rushy, heavily vegetated watercourses and clear, free-running watercourses. Mm-hmm. You'd have ponds which were clear and ponds which were muddy. You'd have poached ground and wet ground and muddy ground and dry, baked and bare ground. You'd have disturbed ground with all the plants that can only really exist in ground which is periodically disturbed. And there's a huge suite of species which depend on disturbance, you know, very often lovely, lovely. The poppies are, you know, the classic species of disturbed ground, you know. And ground which has huge ecological continuity, which might have been under trees or under grass for hundreds and thousands of years. All those on just one farm or one parish of farms and that. I don't see that as a negative, you know. It enabled us to live with nature in ways which we've utterly lost sight of now. You know, you can go through the Sussex countryside, Weald or Downs, all day long and never see a grazing animal. Just endless fields of corn and corn with nothing in it. Corn crammed in so that every stalk is held up by a neighbour stalk crammed in next to it, you know, without any kind of other plants living in their interstices at all, or room for ground nesting birds or insects.
I think many people's experiences of accessing the countryside would feel quite managed. Might even pay an entry fee to gain access to some places. Other times there are parks and gardens that function in a similar way that museums and zoos do, where we might go in an organised manner and look at examples of flowers and plants or animals. Dave's vision of the countryside is completely different. It's a borderless land, which starts at your doorstep and ends only with the limits of your imagination. Not everyone sees it this way, particularly landowners. I wondered how he's overcome this, to continue enjoying nature the way he does.
When me and John went out, and then later when I went out on my own, I don't ever remember thinking about whether we were trespassing or not. As I say, I was on the political right then. I would have been in sympathy with the farmers and landowners in broad political terms. But it was never an issue in my mind that I would just roam freely where I wanted to go. If it looked like anyone was going to get in my way, I'd just make sure I tiptoed round and didn't bump into them, really. Donkeys years later, I was at a conference and about the South Downs. There was a seminar, and I debated with Peter Brandon, the famous geographer and historian, geographical historian and writer of so many brilliant and insightful books on the countryside of Sussex and Surrey and Kent, but a man of the right. I think he was a member of the Conservative Party to the end of his life. He's a lovely man. And I debated with him in this conference about the right to roam, which was then being brought in by the Blairite Labour government, the Countryside Act. And we were on both different sides of the argument. And we ended up, after this seminar, being in the queue in the refectory next to each other in the queue. And we knew each other, so we started chatting. And he looked at me and he said, Dave, he said, when I'm out in the countryside on my own, I do exactly what you do. I hop over the fence, and if there's something I want to look at, I hop over the fence and go and look at it. And we had a little chuckle together, you know, about the fact that behind all the different politics, we actually shared the same. But I remember thinking, why the inconsistency, Peter? You know, Surely what's good for you is good for everyone, isn't it? What you want to enjoy is something which we all have the capacity to enjoy, don't we? We very rarely meet landowners from farmers. The countryside is an empty place now. We don't meet people, good or bad. We don't meet them. It's not difficult to avoid human contact in the Weald or even on the Downs. You keep a weather eye. If you see a truck going along a track, you do your calculations. Is that the gamekeeper? You know, is that the farmer liquoring his stock, or is that who is it? Is it the farmer or is it some contractor? If it's a contractor, you can ignore him. If it's the farmer, you better nip away. Mm-hmm. But mostly we don't see folk out there. Mm-hmm. But when we do see folk, We have sometimes had really painful confrontations, really, and it's always distressing. It's always distressing when someone drives you off the ground. I can't remember the last time it happened that actually someone escorted off the ground. It's years ago now, but the last time that happened. But it does happen, and it's always distressing. And we give as good as we get when we talk to these people, really, you know. I'm not going to apologise for being in nature. I'm not going to apologise for being in the countryside. It's ours. It belongs to us. We have a right to be there. And people need to hear that. And what's extraordinary is when you talk to people is that mostly these farmers and downs have never heard this, actually. I mean, very often their eyes, if you say you believe in the freedom of roam, very often their eyes light up because they've read some article in the Daily Express or the Daily Mail, you know, freedom to roam. We know about that. We've read about trespasses and things like that. And there's a flash of recognition. But mostly when you talk the way we talk, you know, that we're there by right, people don't know how to react. The standard response is, this is private land. You have no right to be here. My standard response is, well, actually, in legal terms, everywhere's private land, really. You might have limited categories on some types of land, like, you know, parks or registered commons and that. But actually all ground, you know, is as the status of private land. And that's not why you're kicking us off, because all ground, whether there's a friendly landowner who doesn't mind you being there or a hostile landowner like you, all ground has the same legal status. Whether to say something is owned by someone privately means nothing, really. What you really mean when you say this is private land is, I don't want you here, get off. I don't want you here, go. That's your message, and I don't accept that message. It's not for you to say that. You know, we buy your products. Very often we help create your products. We distribute your products. Your living depends on our cooperation. You know, in capitalism, nothing is made without the most extraordinary, complex, interwoven division of labour. So you depend on us. We depend on you. I expect from you that you give us something in return, really. You can't control this ground and make your money from selling your products to us, or from buying goods or services or tools that we've made, or from the work we've actually done on your land in the case of land workers and people like that. You can't actually accept all those things and then say we have no rights to enjoy this landscape, which in legal terms is yours. We do have that right. The earth is a common treasury. It belongs to us all, really. The landscape that we all enjoy was made collectively by our ancestors, your ancestors and my ancestors. We all depend on it, really. And we have the right to enjoy what our ancestors made. Quite recently, when I was out with Jane and I think with my grandson out on the downs, only a matter of 3 or 4 years ago, we were up on a down. I won't say where. It was actually a down that was subject to which was statutory access land. It had been made statutory access land, but had never been opened by the farmer. The farmer has never, after nearly 20 years, opened that land to which we have a statutory right of access. So the public never go there, except us. And we do go there. And to get there, when we find his barbed wire fences in the way, we cut them so that we can get our access. So there we were, sitting on the down, having our picnic. And we saw down in the fields below, in the arable fields below, these two figures coming across the landscape. We'd been looking for hares. You know, that time of year in early spring, we're always out looking for, and this was a part of the downs where there's a lot of hares. We saw these two figures crossing this stubble field, this fallow field. And they came near, and we realised there were two lads of about, they were about 13, 14. And they came right on and up the hill and past us. So we hailed them over and talked to them. And it was, honestly, it was such a joyful encounter. I thought it was extraordinary. You know, I grilled them about what they were doing. They had that same habit as me and my brother had at that age. They just wandered freely. So I said, well, what do you call yourselves? You seem to just go everywhere. They said, we do. We just wander wherever we want to go. And it turned out, in fact, that they were doing what we were doing. They were looking for hares, actually. They were clocking hares on this landscape. But I said, well, what do you call yourselves? And you just go, he said, oh, we call it free walking, they said. We're free walkers. And I said, where did you get that? Where did you get that thing that you call yourselves? And he said, one of them said, well, my dad calls it that. He said he taught us to just walk wherever we want to go and that. And we'd been looking for flint tools on the ploughland, and they did the same. And we had one or two tools that we'd found that afternoon. And we had this whole conversation about, and I thought, this is extraordinary. In 40 years, this is the first time I've met a couple of youngsters who completely mirror what me and my brother were like in our youth. It was absolutely delightful to meet these two lads who had exactly the same attitude. There was nothing contrary. There was nothing that I didn't pick up anything about rebellion or contrariness or a will to harm or anything like that from their attitude. They simply assumed that this was their playground. This was where they meant no harm and did no harm.
Dave has spent 40 years exploring this part of England, and I wanted to ask him about some of his favourite places. Somewhere that sticks in my mind is Wolstonbury Hill. It stands watch over the A23. I always see it whenever I'm passing. It's a landmark which tells me I'm home.
I mean, Wolstonbury is a special place. I remember years ago, one hot summer, I'm not sure I don't write about it in the Brighton Downs book, the Freedom to Roam Guide to the Brighton Downs. I remember walking along the face of Wolstonbury one really hot, belting hot summer day along a sheep terracer, you know, along the track there. And I saw an adder curled up in the grass. So I stood there to admire it, you know, and then tiptoed round it and carried on walking. And just beyond me in a dell, there was a guy sitting in this dell. And I said, I just seen an adder up there. And he said, oh, he said, I've just seen a Roman legionnaire. He said, and I kind of did a double take. Well, I think, well, okay, you know. And I said, well, what do you mean? Tell me about it. And he said, yeah, I was just sitting here. And this guy came up all in his uniform, his doublet and his, you know, the skirt and with his shield and sword and that, he just marched up from me and then clinked up the hill and over the top of the hill. And I thought, well, I don't know what's going on in your head, and I don't really care, because this is a very, very hot belting summer day, a liminal day, you know, when all the boundaries between reality are breaking and non-reality are breaking down. So just fine by me, you know. And we just talked some more about this, and I wandered on, you know, and left him there in his amazement at what he'd just seen, really, you know. Yeah, quite extraordinary, quite extraordinary. And yeah, I do have a very, very special places. I mean, for me, the places where you go, or rather the times when you go, are as important as the places where you go. So for the last couple of weekends, last weekend and the weekend before, I've taken out one of my smaller grandkids, step-grandchildren, to see glowworms. And we went out onto Offham Down last weekend, and it was completely magical, you know, with the sky turning apricot and then through apricot into steely grey and blue black, and then the first stars coming up, and as the first stars come up, these stars in the grass, absolutely extraordinary, you know, to see that. And there, you know, so it's as though the sky has fallen down to earth, you know, as the stars appear in the sky, they appear in the grass at the same time. Quite extraordinary. Another really thing that always gets to me, which is very, very new in my life, is the wildlife of streams. I've really only been looking intensively at this for the last decade or so, or even less, in a very intense way. Mm. And this discovery, and it feels to me like a discovery of the discovery of another world, is the discovery of the chalk streams where the sea trout, the giant Sussex sea trout, spawn in winter. We have our own race of sea trout in the Middle Sussex rivers, and this race of sea trout are quite distinctive. They're bigger in size than other varieties, and they spawn later. So they're spawning in around Christmas time, through the end of November and into December. But the best time for finding them is around Christmas, the days before Christmas and the days after Christmas. And to go out into these bleak Sussex woods and thorn thickets and along these wet sides of these wet pastures and tilled fields, and to hunt along there, to see these gravel mounds appearing just below the spate, made by these giant creatures, you know, coming back from these long journeys, probably way over in the North Sea, near the continental coast, you know, near the North Germany and the Low Countries. And to see them making their way up that river, and you can see them, you can stand only a matter of two or three paces from where they're lying in the scrapes that they've made in the gravel and coupling and spawning. It's just a real piece of magic, you know. It just breaks down all the boundaries between their world and our own world, or the world of the deepest past, the world that goes way back to the time of the glaciers, because these are cold water creatures, you know. They're creatures of the clear, cold northern streams, really. And to see them surviving, you know, in these streams where they must have been not just back to the end of the Age of Ice, to the end of the Pleistocene, but probably through the Pleistocene, coming up in these streams, and to see them still there, clinging on, only a matter of a few fields away from pubs and village streets, where we've walked, and never would it have occurred to us that these giant beasts are still living this incredible primeval existence, you know. Those kind of experiences absolutely tug at me, you know. I did one I've been doing this year that has been really lovely this summer, has been going out onto the forest, onto Ashdown, but also onto our own Middle Sussex Forest, Worth Forest, and looking for roding woodcock. The woodcock in the summer, the males, and I think maybe even the females, at around dusk, they fly on a set course around their territory just above the height of the woodland or scrub cover. They fly with these rapid wing movements, but not very fast, and grunt as they fly over. So you hear them, their wings paddling through the air. You see them coming towards you going, hoo, 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 like this, with these great, long, crazy beaks, you know, that they have, like something out of, you know, Harry Potter, you know. Mm-hmm. And you see these things through the dusk coming through, and in the background you've got cuckoo, and as the night sets in, you've got nightjar coming up, and as you make your way back through the forest to the road, you can see the stars of the glowworms in the grass. I mean, what could beat that? You know, that is, you know, I can't see how you can beat an experience like that, really. It's a kind of pure magic. It's being transported into another world, or worlds and worlds, you know. I mean, how can you beat that, sitting in a effing pub, down in them, you know? You can't beat the otherworldliness that you get in nature, really. You know, if you want to get out of your head, get out of your house, really. That's the, you know, get out and immerse yourself in what's out there waiting for you, really, you know, because there's just worlds on worlds on worlds out there, you know. I remember last midsummer, not this summer, the midsummer before, I set off in the middle of the night to go out to celebrate the solstice and that, over in West Sussex by the Rother there. And I travelled through these woods in the last stages of the night, pitch black, and not motoring at more than 20 mile an hour, maybe less than that. I don't like motoring fast at the best of times. And there I was, pootling through down this lane through these darkest woods with moths, like a snowstorm, which we think has gone, but not there. You can still find that in clouds of moss around the windscreen. And there in front of me, caught in the headlights, is a polecat lolloping across the road. And the headlights catch her. I slam the brake on and stop. And there, pulled in the headlights in front of me, she does a little dance for me. She runs around in a circle, round and round and round, and then leaps up in the air and then pelts off through the fence into the wood at the side. And I'm left sitting there with the car ticking over and thinking, God damn it, what was that about? What was that about? You know, I mean, I'm used to finding polecats and polecat ferrets dead and squashed and wretched by the side of the road. You know, I've found three or four of them over the years, you know. But to see one of these creatures, never before have I seen a polecat in its own world like that. And unhurried and unfazed, and even prepared to put on a performance for me, you know, just for me alone, you know. That's just magic, pure magic, you know.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, Dave, for the interview. I'll put links to Dave's books and links to his mural artwork in the description of the podcast. I hope you can go out and find your own piece of magic, wherever you are. Bye for now.